Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
President Barack Obama reaffirms the U.S. commitment to the Asia-Pacific region and global opposition to Russian aggression in Ukraine. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. President Barack Obama says the United States, as the world's only superpower, has a unique responsibility to lead the world in destroying the terrorist group ISIL, fighting Ebola in West Africa, and battling climate change, among other issues. In a speech on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Australia this weekend, the president vowed Washington will remain focused on the Asia-Pacific region.
I decided that given the importance of this region to American security, to American prosperity, the United States would rebalance our foreign policy and play a larger and lasting role in this region. And that's exactly what we've done.
The president also announced the U.S. is contributing $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund to help pay for early warning systems and stronger defenses against storm surges. Boko Haram has seized a northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok, the home of 200 schoolgirls the group kidnapped earlier this year. Chris Stein reports for VOA.
On motorcycles and trucks, hundreds of fighters belonging to the extremist group Boko Haram overran the Nigerian military and local vigilantes to take control of the town.
The local vigilante did put up a fight with the contingent of the military that's in Chibok, but they were outgunned because the Boko Haram came in very large numbers.
Vitris says he believes the extremists took over the government girls' secondary school, previously stormed in April during the kidnapping. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
President Obama says the U.S. is leading the opposition against Russia's aggression against Ukraine. Speaking from Australia, Mr. Obama said that Russia is a threat to the world as witnessed in the downing of MH17. A Malaysia Airlines flight. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says the unease between eastern Ukraine and the rest of the country must be resolved through dialogue with Russian-backed separatists. President Vladimir Putin of Russia says he wants to compromise with Ukraine, but denies having any soldiers or weapons in the rebel-controlled areas. A powerful earthquake has struck just off the coast of Indonesia, leading to a tsunami warning for areas up to 300 kilometers away. The 7.3 magnitude quake occurred just after 10:30 this morning local time. There have been no immediate reports of casualties or damage. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the U.S. nuclear arsenal is suffering from low morale and mismanagement, and he's promised nearly $10 billion in new funding. VOA's Carla Babb reports.
Secretary Hagel says America's nuclear enterprise is flooded with problems, including inadequate manning, infrastructure, equipment, accountability, and declining morale.
The internal and external reviews I ordered showed that a consistent lack of investment and support for our nuclear forces over far too many years has left us with too little margin to cope with mounting stresses.
Hagel says all these shortfalls could eventually jeopardize the program's safety and effectiveness. Carla Babb, VOA News, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota.
The White House has announced a plan to grant refugee status in the United States to certain children living in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Vice President Joe Biden announced the new program Friday.
We are launching what we refer to as an in-country refugee processing for certain minors in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador who meet the international standards for asylum. Starting in early December, this program will allow parents who have lawfully resided in the United States to request U.S. refugee resettlement for children still in one of those three countries without having to make the harrowing trip.
Mr. Biden says it will give those seeking asylum a right way to come to the U.S. instead of crossing the border illegally. Under the plan, those 21 years old and younger with at least one parent who is a legal resident of the U.S. can qualify. United Nations investigators say Islamic State militants are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity on a large scale in areas under the group's control in Syria. In a report released Friday, a U.N. panel focusing on acts by IS and in Syria found the jihadist group's fighters are guilty of massacres, beheadings, torture, sexual enslavement, and forced pregnancy. The panel said the group also deploys its fighters close to civilian areas, including homes and farms. The UN expert said children have been among the victims. The leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan meeting today in Islamabad have called for a joint effort to curb extremism and terrorism. In 3 days of discussion and negotiation, Afghan's new president, Ashraf Ghani, and Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif discussed easing the decade of tensions between the two Muslim countries. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Le charte de la transition a été adopté à l'unanimité.
The charter is being celebrated as a compromise that bodes well for the months ahead.
Burkina Faso leaders agreed to form a transitional government following the ouster of longtime dictator Blaise Compaoré.
A man who has failed to discharge the core responsibility of a president to the protection of life and property has no moral right.
A major Nigerian opposition party questions the moral justification of President Goodluck Jonathan to seek re-election, citing the deteriorating security situation.
All power belongs to the people. And we believe President Museveni is among the people of Uganda. Although he's the president, first and foremost, is a Ugandan.
And Ugandan groups schedule a major national conference to discuss electoral reforms. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. It has been 2 weeks since what many in Burkina Faso are calling the revolution that pushed out longtime President Blaise Compaoré. The military, politicians, and civil society have finally agreed on the framework for a transition. The next step is to choose the interim civilian president, a process that local analysts say could take at least a week. Viewers and Luke has more on what lies ahead with reporting in Ouagadougou by Zumana Wonogo.
There was joy and a few sighs of relief in Ouagadougou when the charter for the transition passed late Thursday after a week of haggling. A game of, quote, ping pong, to quote one opposition leader.
The charter de la transition a été adopté à l'unanimité.
The charter is being celebrated as a compromise that bodes well for the months ahead. The military bent to demands from civil society and opposition politicians. There will be a 90-member National Transition Council that has legislative powers and is led by a civilian. That council's seats will go to 30 opposition politicians, 25 soldiers, 25 civil society members, and 10 representatives of the ex-ruling party. Acting President Lieutenant Colonel Yakuba Isaac Zida must now sign the charter, which he is expected to do by Monday. Mr. Zida declared himself head of state 2 weeks ago when Blaise Compaoré stepped down. Mr. Compaoré had been in power for 27 years. He fled the country after 4 days of street protests against his efforts to change the constitution and run for another term. Members of his government are ineligible for posts during the transition. The charter also stipulates that those who, quote, openly supported Mr. Compaoré's efforts to change the constitution cannot sit on the National Transition Council. Mr. Zida has agreed to hand over power to an interim civilian president who will appoint a 25-member government. Leaving the vote Thursday, Mr. Zida said they have supported handing over to a civilian since the beginning, but that leader should not be a politician. If it's a politician, he said, we don't have the guarantee that when it comes to organizing elections, this politician wouldn't work in favor of his party. He says, quote, we want this to be someone impartial and chosen by consensus. Once Mr. Zida signs the charter, the country will convene a 23-member panel to choose the president. It will include 8 religious and traditional leaders. The other 15 seats will be divided equally among the military, the opposition, and civil society.
Une des innovations, c'est que les chefs coutumiers et religieux ne proposeront pas de candidats. Mais ils auront une place prépondérante dans le collège de désignation.
Spokesman for a civil society coalition, Luke Ibriga, says the religious and traditional leaders will not propose any names. The other 3 groups can each propose 3 civilians. He says the panel will narrow that list of 9 names down to 3. Those 3, he says, will be called in to make their cases, and the panel will then pick one. There will not be a vote, he says. The interim president will then be tasked with leading the country to elections in November of 2015. The interim president and members of his government cannot run in that election, nor can the head of the National Transition Council. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Meanwhile, the African Union has welcomed as a positive development the agreement between Burkina Faso's military, opposition and civil society groups to a framework on a transitional administration. Jacob Eno Eben, spokesperson for the AU chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, told me that the African Union is hopeful that all Burkinabe stakeholders, including the military leadership, will expedite the implementation of the agreement to ensure the West African country quickly restores constitutional rule.
I should say it's a welcome indicator of progress between the stakeholders within Burkina Faso to have had the current military-led leadership have conversations with the civilians, both those from the opposition political parties, the party that was in power, as well as the civil society, including, of course, those of the religious faith, to really chart a way forward for Burkina Faso in a manner that is agreeable, to have reached this sort of consensus. We think it's a welcome agreement. We are looking forward to, you know, them signing it, hopefully between today and tomorrow, and hopefully thereafter they would be able to appoint a civilian-led government of transition.
What role is the African Union going to play in helping Burkina Faso return quickly to constitutional order?
The role the AU is playing is that of being supportive of the leadership within the country. That role, the AU started playing it before the crisis even escalated, and even when it escalated, the appointment of a special envoy, and also the involvement of the president of the union, or the chairperson of the union, in making sure that conversations happen in a manner that is able to lead the country towards the direction that the Burkinabes themselves want.
So what do you say to critics of the AU who say that the AU was too quick to demand a two-week transitional period that the military administration hand over power, and that was rejected by the military designated leader there? What do you say to critics who say that the African Union should have been a little bit more circumspect before coming out with such an ultimatum?
Well, depending on the angle from which you look at things, there are those that said the AU was too quick, as you're saying. There are also those that said that, the AU is now sort of going against its own constitutive act and the Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance to say that when there is a situation like this, it should immediately slam in sanctions. And that's not what the Peace and Security Council thought. The Peace and Security Council thought that immediately after the situation escalated, as we saw at the end of October, the AU appointed a special envoy who was joined by the UN special envoy as well as ECOWAS leadership to go into the country and have conversations. And so in the midst of having that conversations to find out a solution, the AU thought rather than slamming sanctions immediately, it could have been counterproductive, but rather it was important to give a reasonable period of time, which 2 weeks as they decided, during which they hoped that the transition would have happened.
So at the moment, Burkina Faso does not risk sanctions following latest developments there, correct?
Things are progressing well, as we see, and we are hoping that by the time the Peace and Security Council meets again early next week, the Burkinabe stakeholders would have signed the charter which they agreed, hopefully today or tomorrow. They would be able to just proceed to, you know, get the constitution again functional, and then the charter would just be hopefully part of the constitution, which will enable them to agree on who would be the civilian-led leader.
Jacob Eno Eben is the spokesperson for the AU chairperson. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Nigeria's main opposition All Progressive Congress, or APC party, said President Goodluck Jonathan lacks the moral right to seek a second full-year term in office. This following what the group says has been the deteriorating security situation in the country. Alhaji Lai Mohammed, spokesman for the APC, told me that President Jonathan so far has been unable to carry out his fundamental constitutional mandate to protect life and property. He says the country faces increasing violence often carried out by the Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram.
What the APC opposition party thinks is that a man who has failed to discharge the core responsibility of a president, which is the protection of life and property, has no moral right to seek for re-election. And our position is further strengthened by the fact that under the watch of President Jonathan, Nigeria has lost more people to insurgency, intra-ethnic wars than under any president in peacetime Nigeria. In the last 5 years, this government has spent about $32 billion on security. And what do we have for it?
Supporters of the president are saying that the APC is just playing mere politics with the lives of Nigerians, especially when the government has been doing everything in its power to protect Nigerians, invested a lot, getting help from the international community to fight terrorism, which the government says is a global phenomenon. So these accusations, they say, are just politically motivated. What is your reaction to that?
If anybody is politicizing the insurgency, I think it's the president and his party. In the sense that if only the president had addressed the Boko Haram insurgency with acidity, probably would not have the kind of mess we have in our hands today. On the contrary, the response of the president to the Boko Haram insurgency has been characterized by denial and incompetence. And I think the APC frontline states have contributed much more than even the federal government, because we are the casualty, we are the frontline casualty this business, in this unfortunate war. And I know that the Borno State government has given several billions of naira to the war effort. Now, it is the incompetence and corruption of this government, rather than the politicization on the part of APC, that has brought us to this story time, this story pass.
Supporters say that the APC was against Boko Haram to be declared a terrorist organization, following the U.S. decision to name it as such. And they said that the apparent support and the fact that the APC was opposed to it shows that the APC is supporting these nefarious activities of violence carried out by the Boko Haram terrorist group. And they say that it appears that the APC would use this as a political capital to gain momentum at the next year general election. What say you?
No, you see, it's logical to even think that way. Now, if the Boko Haram insurgency should continue this way, there will be more internal displaced people in the northeastern part of Nigeria. And those are people who normally would have voted for the APC. Now, as things are today, if it's not possible for voters in the Northeast to participate in 2015 election, it will be to the advantage of PDP and to the disadvantage of APC. Now, these people who have been talking about APC being the end of Boko Haram, first
to accept the fact that Boko Haram is more than 10 years old. APC is less than 2 years old. So how do you link APC with Boko Haram? Of course, when a government is incompetent, what it does is try to shift blame.
Alhaji Lai Mohammed is the spokesman of Nigeria's main opposition All Progressive Congress, APC. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Lagos. Meanwhile, the Nigerian extremist group Boko Haram overran the town of Chibok Friday. Earlier this year, Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls from the town, most of whom remain in captivity. For VOA, Chris Stein reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Boko Haram returned to the town of Chibok this week, 7 months after it kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in a mass abduction that sparked international outrage. On motorcycles and trucks, hundreds of fighters belonging to the extremist group overran the Nigerian military and local vigilantes to take control of the town. Pogo Bitris is chairman of the Chibok Elders Forum.
The Boko Haram attacked Chibok between 4 and 5 yesterday. And the local vigilante did put up a fight with the contingent of the military that's in Chibok, but they were outgunned because the Boko Haram came in very large numbers.
Bitris says he believes the extremists took over the government girls' secondary school, which they had previously stormed in April during the kidnapping. The mass abduction sparked a campaign of protests on the streets and on social media to push the Nigerian government to rescue the schoolgirls. Some girls who escaped from Boko Haram shortly after the abduction returned to Chibok after their ordeal, but Bitris said none of them were in town at the time it was overrun. Instead, the town was filled with many people displaced by fighting in Borno State and elsewhere in Nigeria's northeast. Boko Haram has overrun towns and villages in Borno State, which is one of three the government has placed under emergency rule because of the militants. Bitris says not everybody in the town was able to escape.
Aged like my old man are still trapped in Chibok. What has become of them, we don't know. My old dad is about 104 years. He's trapped in Chibok. My stepmother, they're all there trapped in Chibok. So there are so many people who are still trapped in Chibok with the Boko Haram.
Bitris says military reinforcements are heading for Chibok. A vigilante leader also told him that he plans to lead a counterattack to liberate the town.
I spoke with him at about 12 noon. And he told me he was getting in touch with the military commander in Biu with a view to getting to Chibok, mobilizing those of his boys who had escaped, who have run out of ammunition, with a view to getting involved in the attack to recapture Chibok.
Bitris says he will continue to campaign for the girls' release. But with their town in the control of militants, it is not clear where they can return to if freed. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
And Seal of Hope, a U.S.-based nonprofit organization, has been shipping medical supplies to countries in West Africa where it's hit by the Ebola disease. Georgios Kuchu, the head of the group, said his organization is raising funds to buy more medical supplies and food to be sent to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. He told me that the Seal of Hope has so far sent over 62 tons of medical gloves to be used by health officials at the forefront of the fight against the deadly Ebola virus.
What we did first is to look at the situation around June and July and see what we can do to change the situation when it was not like the way what it is today. And we figured out that gloves were not available in hospitals. And since we cannot bring the cure, we can stop the spray. So we decided to supply gloves and other medical supplies. And we were able to send with other organizations about 62 tons of material to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and lastly in Guinea.
How beneficial has this gesture been, and will that continue?
No, this gesture is really, really beneficial because if the Ebola cannot spread, that means it is contained, and then it can be taken care of, and eradication will be a matter of time.
What other aspect are you looking at, especially in this fight against Ebola?
No, right now we are looking for the Ebola itself and the after Ebola. First of all, we are ready to send more supply. We gathered some supply already, and then we are ready to send them to affected countries and non-affected countries. Why we are doing this? Because affected countries, we know that they still need supply, and they even need a food supply. We have seeds that we want to send too, because we know that one of the consequences of this outbreak will be a food shortage, will be food crisis, because people are not producing, and this will be very dangerous. So we're going to send food, we're going to send seed, and we're going to send other medical supplies to people. So if they can produce more in the region, the government can be able to control the level of inflation of price. Otherwise, this could lead to another major political crisis, and then we will be talking about something else.
Georges Kuchu is the head of the Seal of Hope, a U.S.-based nonprofit organization. He spoke with me here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. In Uganda, a coalition of civil society, religious leaders, political parties, and the labor movement is to convene a national conference on electoral reforms. According to organizers, the conference, called the National Dialogue, is meant to involve all citizens in the democratic governance of their country. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached one of them, Father Gaetano Batanyenda, to find out what the National Dialogue is about.
Since July this year, civil society organizations, together with the political parties who have been touring the whole country, meeting different groups of people, civic educating them on certain salient issues on elections, governance, democracy, and so forth. Now we are going to have a national one, which will be composed of 1,000 people. And we hope His Excellency the President will open the conference. Practically, that is what it is about. We are going to have this national conference composed of all Ugandans.
You mentioned you'll invite the President to open the conference. As you're aware, the government has not been forthcoming on electoral reforms. Do you think you'll have the full support of government to implement your reforms?
My dear friend, I think surely if we believe in our constitutionalism and in the rule of law and constitutionalism. Chapter 1, Article 1 of the Constitution of Uganda of 1995, which President Museveni, when launching, held it as the best constitution, says all power belongs to the people. And we believe President Museveni is among the people of Uganda, although he's the president, first and foremost, is a Ugandan. So we are inviting him in that capacity as a Ugandan, first, then as the president of Uganda. So if he doesn't come, it will not be our fault. So we want to join us that all together, irrespective of political beliefs, religious beliefs, and so forth, we move as Ugandans.
Have the government or police sanctioned your conference? Because in the past, the authorities have been known to stop such conferences.
We know the law, although that law is obnoxious, but we know the law, we know what the government wants. I think we have put in place the machinery to prepare that. Yes, we shall follow the law. We have already formed the government which in time. We haven't had any contrary view. So I hope it will take place.
If your recommendations are not adopted by government, what do you hope intend to do?
My dear friend, let us not be pessimistic. We have no doubt that our recommendations will not be taken on by the government. First of all, our recommendations will go to the parliament. The parliament will discuss these recommendations. I'm sure there are many other recommendations, maybe from the cabinet or from the other groups, I don't know. But we believe that they will be recommended. They will be taken on. If they are not taken on, then we shall see what to do next.
The Ugandan Minister for Justice, General Kahindo Tafile, had said that they would accept proposals from stakeholders by November 21st. And your conference is after that. Will that affect your conference?
When Tafile announced that, he was informed that the civil society organizations, together with the political parties, were having our conference on 24th, 25th, and 26th. I'm sure Otafire being a party, what he saw our request, and he accepted that we should go ahead. And afterwards, then we forward to him our proposals.
That was Father Gaetano Batanyenda, one of the organizers of the Ugandan National Dialogue scheduled for later this month. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kampala. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Share officer, not to be the bear. J'ai dit de Jonathan, ouais, Joe le magicien, Jonathan, Jonathan, Maero,
la musique,
Maero,
la musique,
Maero,
la musique,
Maero,
la musique,
Jonathan, Maero,
la musique,
Maero,
la musique,
Maero,
la musique,
Maero,
la musique.
On a pleuré pour Jonathan. Oh, oh y'a Jonathan, 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 Jonathan. Oh, ce qui fait la douce lingala. Oh, 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 Jonathan. Oh, Jonathan. Oh, 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 y'a j'ai balle pour con. Ma commande à mecho. Petit mecho, moi, Manila, Mario. Malélo,
la musique,
Malélo,
la musique,
Malélo. Maman, si la structure internationale, bah, on
va. La musique.
Développement tout le monde. En pleurs pour Jonathan. Bamoukoulouko DJ. Yolera. 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 Arrapaté, moi, n'a chiquité. Mano, mano, roula, me bagne, c'est bien. Père, ma loulou, Franco. Ape. Ape. On a pleuré quand on est allé à la morgue sur Jonathan. J'ai dit vraiment ça faisait pitié parce que si tu voyais Jonathan, c'est vraiment mon frère, tu allais trop pleurer.
Pleurer pour toi, tout sangana ya bébé. Arafat témoigne, Mouloukou DJ, tout sangana ya mama. Oh, oh, bébé, toi, tout sangana ya moué. Bébé, kakou, tous les cas, Kodia. Ah, Mama, non, 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 non,
Katuse, Donatane, tu resteras gravé dans les mémoires. Oh, mon âme, ma doleka, karobe. Ah, krikata, 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 pam pam. Arafat témoigne, dosanga baroke. Krikata, 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 pam pam. Dans la musique, doleka. So mouton, so mouton, so mouton, so mouton, so mouton. Ouais, mon coco DJ batte mon gourou gourou. Doleka, Arafat témoigne. Docteur Viera, maman Germaine. Ouais, le Congolais, c'est parti TV3. Dans les cas, ah, s'amusez-moi, s'amusez-moi. Pepe Kaku, on aurait tous les bisous, bisous, naïe. Mouloukoukou, DJ, chante pour vous. Jonathan, il repose en payé. Dans les cas, ah, il sort, c'est la naïe. Applaudissez. Il n'est pas mort, il est dans ta mémoire. Arafat, témoin, un tout, tout, tout. Mama seka moke balula yo Suswa ma cheke bango bata la bonga balula yo Kamera kabata buaka sima buaka kabata buaka
This one, na yebe aujo Let we all body na the support
Papa de kole
music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Every week, I pay close attention to the passing events in the world, and I pay close attention to American policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, there are many events going on around the world, and they have implications for U.S. policy towards Africa. Most importantly, from my point of view, is the conference in Asia, where President Obama visited China and then went to the Asia-Pacific, or what some people now call the Trans-Pacific Alliance. Now, there are a number of things to be done with regard to this situation. One is the African summit took place a couple of months ago, and 50 African states assembled in the United States. And this was a very important development in terms of U.S. policy towards Africa. When you look back after the summit and what transpired since then, of course, unfortunately for most of the African countries and the African media, Ebola became dominant. It became the most discussed issue in the American media and in American society. So if you're looking at American policy towards Africa, you have to identify what transpired after the summit and how U.S. policy is affecting Africa and African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States is affected. With Ebola, the U.S. intervened strongly on the humanitarian ground in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and of course Guinea. But most importantly, Liberia and Sierra Leone. These two countries do have historical relevance with regard to the English-speaking people and their relationship with black people historically. Sierra Leone, of course, has Freetown, the name of that country's capital, which goes back to the abolitionist movement. And you can see how Sierra Leone is very much linked not only to the abolitionist movement and the slave trade, but it's also linked to malaria. And of course, the former president of Australia, Sir Stevens, immortalized the African encounter with malaria by creating the so-called Malaria Award. So if you're looking at American policy towards Africa, you try to look at these historical connections, anecdotes, similes, metaphors, and analogies, and see how they affect American policy towards Africa. Today, the Center for Disease Control, which was unknown to many Africans, is now very much part of the African vocabulary, particularly in Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea. And you can even go all the way to Nigeria, because Nigeria was briefly affected. So was Senegal. But these two countries became Ebola-free for some reason. And today, the center of attraction of American policy with regard to Ebola is Liberia. And, of course, the incident involving the Liberian in Texas, a big state in the United States, also affected not only Texans, people from Houston, and American policy towards Africa. So when you look at the Obama phenomena with regard to what is happening between the United States and Africa, the United States and the rest of the world, the development in Asia has consequences for Africa, because the South Africans have strong relationships now with these Asian countries. And South Africa is the only African country which is a member of BRICS, meaning Brazil, Russia, India, and China. This is a new coalition of non-Western countries who are now beginning to create a new dialogue in world affairs. And they have implications for Africa. They are likely to affect U.S.-Africa relations. So two points need to be underscored here. One is President Obama's visit to China and his visit to the Asia Summit has implications for Africa, because if the Chinese can work out an economic deal with America, then you have a new relationship in world trade, because the Chinese economy is rising. And now some of the economies are anticipating that the Chinese may become the number one economy. If that is true, there's the relationship between the Chinese and the United States. But how does that affect Africa's policy? And this is where the Africans have to pay good attention to what the summit in Asia means for Africa, because Brazil has a relationship with Africa, Russia has a relationship with Africa, India has a relationship with Africa, and of course, most importantly now, the Chinese. So this is a bone of contention for the bloggers, the protesters on television, for the journalists in Africa. So I will not be surprised to see many editorials written by African journalists all over the continent, and all these Africans who have their internet blogging going on. The second point that needs to be underscored here is, how does that summit in Asia affect Africa? During the Cold War, when Truman was trying to contain communism, the African countries, Asian countries, were all involved. You have NATO, and they have CETO, which involves so many Southeast Asian countries that were fighting the communists. And of course, you also have CENTO, which didn't last long because the Arabs were opposed to it, particularly NASA and the Arab nationalists. And of course, today, when we look at the rise of BRICS and the manner in which BRICS can negotiate positively with the West in coming up with a new political disposition in the world, the African leaders who had a summit with the United States and had organized summits with China, India, and Japan, and Brazil in their own ways. The last question to be asked then is, where are the Africans going, and how are they going to engage America so that before President Obama's term comes to an end, another summit, which will be conceptualized differently and formulated differently, so that this time you'll have long-lasting relationship between the United States and Africa. And this is the bone of contention. And this is what both American leaders on this side of the aisle, or the Atlantic, where now the Republicans are going to dominate the Senate and the Congress, and they have to negotiate successfully with the president to come up with a new Africa policy in this new debate against BRICS. And that's the way it is today. And I leave it that way.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Fraser, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the Mozambican elders say, witch doctors do not sell their potions to each other. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury announced on November 6th the designation of Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo, a prolific cocaine supplier to Mexican cartels for more than a decade, pursuant to the Foreign Narcotics Kingpin Designation Act. In addition, and also under the Kingpin Act, Treasury is designating Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo's brother, Santiago Perez Ocampo, and one Colombian import company, Compra Venta Herpes. As a result of this action, all assets of those designated that are based in the United States or are in the control of U.S. persons are frozen, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with them. Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo is being designated for his role as a significant international narcotics trafficker and for his ties to the Sinaloa cartel. He has also partnered with numerous international drug trafficking organizations, including the Beltran Leyva Organization and La Familia Michoacana in Mexico, Los Cachiros in Honduras, and Los Urbeños in Colombia. The Treasury Department is also designating Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo's brother, Santiago Perez Ocampo, for providing support to Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo's drug trafficking activities. This action was taken in close coordination with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo is one of the last remaining old guard drug traffickers in Colombia. Through his criminal association with high-level Mexican drug traffickers, Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo was able to export multi-ton kilo quantities of cocaine. The DEA continues to go after the highest-level drug traffickers, as evidenced by the designation of Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo by the U.S. Treasury Department as a drug kingpin, said A.D. Wright, DEA, Miami Field Division, acting special agent in charge. Since June 2000, more than 1,600 entities and individuals have been named pursuant to the Kingpin Act for their role in international narcotics trafficking. Despite being a prominent narcotics trafficker, Herman Alberto Perez Ocampo evaded law enforcement for more than a decade, said Adam Zubin, director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control. His work supplying cocaine to many of the most violent drug cartels targeted by the U.S. government underscores his global reach, and it is time that he is brought to justice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.